9. Breaking Sad. Bringing Down the Mockbells. 2005 to 2006. Tony Mockbell looked and sounded like a soft touch. His associates knew differently. Mockbell's inner sanctum, let's call them the Chemical Brothers, included Tony's brothers and a wider gang of drug dealers, cooks, crooks, and standover men. Walter White, the Breaking Bad character, was still years away, but the Chemical Brothers were masquerading as his real-life prototypes. They conjured the highest quality drugs. Their product pulsed through Melbourne's nightclub scene and beyond. But being a Chemical Brother could be seriously stressful. They had to somehow survive the hazards of their calling. Guns to the head, drives in car boots, and an alarming tendency to use what they trafficked. Their trade was a balancing act of secrets, strip club exchanges, and glass containers. One Chemical Brother had been asked to repay $5 million that one of his paymasters, Nick Radev, said he now owed him. That supposed debt was thought to be the reason why Radev was killed by gangland chiefs in 2003. There were other similarities between Walter White and the Chemical Brothers. One, when he was off the clock, was a family man. Another did the White story in reverse. He later gave up drug production to go into teaching. Pseudonyms must be used to describe these men and the roles they played for Mockbell. Mr. Average was a skillful criminal who resented his chosen trade. By now, he worked mainly for the Mockbells, but he didn't care for them. He was softer than his bosses. Mr. Money did the numbers, and Mr. Beautiful pressed the pills. The apprentice, as with Breaking Bad's Jesse Pinkman, wanted to learn all the techniques of the trade from the associates, such as how to launder money in betting binges at casinos, how to cook chemicals, and how to stay alive. The Chemical Brothers propelled the big profits. Mockbell fought off his competitors to employ their skills. Like every self-respecting drug lord, he relied upon local and international arms for supply. And Rob Karam was his man at the docks. The Chemical Brothers were involved in the odd car chase and shootout with criminals, but they were ordinary too. One shopped at Bunnings, much like a suburban dad attending to the back deck. He was a regular at Crown Casino's mahogany room, who also fretted about paying his bills. As part of Mockbell's crew, Nicola Gobbo naturally became familiar with the Chemical Brothers. In some cases, very familiar. She flirted with several of them. One had known Nicola Gobbo for a few years since she first represented him on drug-related charges. But by 2005, professional pretenses had washed away. They now spoke about the what-ifs of a relationship. She saw his doctor about rehab on his behalf. She teased him by complaining of a lack of sex. Throughout the manic final months of 2005, she made herself useful to the crew in any way she could. She babysat their kids and exchanged Easter eggs with them. Once, when a Chemical Brother became indisposed, she took his kids to a shopping centre to keep them occupied. She always answered their calls. We cannot hear their conversations, but she played the role of confidant, sounding board, and advisor. Like the other Chemical Brothers, Mr. Average came to rely on Gobbo. He was in and out and up and down, but he always gravitated to the one person he trusted. What Mr. Average didn't know was that his life was trickier than he figured. Gobbo was betraying him. Gobbo's feelings for the Chemical Brothers defied easy categorization. She nominated Mr. Average to police as the Mockbell's one-way ticket to prison. The one downside was that her friend would be sacrificed in the pursuit. She was capable of condemning him, but feeling sorry for him too. He was the latest in a line tracing back to her housemate and boss in the 1990s. Her head and her heart sat in opposing camps. By early 2006, she found interactions with him difficult and draining, but but she declined a police invitation to stop informing, the first of many. But she wondered how long her cocktease approach could last. Both have since said their flirting never went beyond chatter. She also continued to mine the other chemical brothers for information. She learned more about the origins of illicit drugs than any lawyer needs to know. She recited terms such as ketone and hydriotic acid to her police handlers with ease. The chemical brothers described making meth as others describe art. It's a tricky business, and even the best sometimes came close to perishing in lab explosions, which were inevitable from time to time. In 2001, a neighbour who asked why one of the chemical brothers was bolting from his house was told, "You'll find out," moments before a suburban explosion. They also had to contend with noxious gases. Mockbell's pop-up labs sometimes relied upon garden hoses threaded down toilets to expel the fumes. No wonder they were often described as being off their heads. Gobbo's handlers reminded her about the need to maintain professional relationships with criminals, but she didn't, or couldn't. After almost a decade as a lawyer, she thrived on pushing the boundaries with clients. Now, as 3838, she toted an unofficial license to do so. She knew some of the chemical brothers had tired of the Mockbells' use of them. Tony Mockbell was paranoid. Once, he sent someone along to watch a cook to make sure the hired help didn't skim anything off the top for himself. Gobbo would testify in a closed court in 2017. The person that he sent actually died during the cook, and the help had to deal with the dead body, so he was angry, resentful. Bitterness inspired one of the henchmen to give Gobbo a copy of Leap of Faith, a Steve Martin comedy film about a crooked faith healer. "He's a shocking criminal," Gobbo told her handlers of Steve Martin's character. "Dishonest, lying piece of human waste who becomes this kind of preaching evangelist. And the reason the henchman gives it to me is," he says, "I found this movie and it's exactly how Tony Mockbell is. He has all these people under his spell and they believe him and do exactly what he says and they don't question him." Gobbo was now passing on the intricate details of major crimes, such as exchanges of chemicals in a McDonald's car park. She described gangland's jungle floor of grudges and schemes, who trusted whom and who did not, who was funding the meth cooks. Such unfettered detail was invaluable to investigators. They played cat and mouse with criminals long trained to avoid police detection. The chemical brothers swapped cars as readily as they changed phones. They knew about mobile phone triangulation, which pinpoints a person's whereabouts, and other investigative tactics that police seek to cloak. What they did not know about was Nicola Gobbo. Gobbo had been eager to please her handlers, White and Smith, at their first meeting. She suggested that an MDID detective, Sergeant Dale Flynn, could appear at Gobbo's regular hangout, the Emerald Hotel, where she would be drinking with a Mockbell associate. "Let the man down a few scotches first," she suggested. "Then he might talk to Flynn." She discussed delaying the date of one of the Chemical Brothers' sentencing for earlier charges to ensure an upcoming police sting could go uninterrupted. It's no small thing to lie to a judge about your reasons for an adjournment. The way Gobbo put it, it sounded like a doddle. She had bigger considerations, such as getting the Mockbells out of my life. By December 2005, Gobbo had a specific tip for her handlers to bring down Mockbell's empire. She was targeting the underlings. Investigators circled, but no arrests were made. Gobbo attended the Mockbells' New Year's Eve party, where Tony had his own fireworks alongside the city's multi-million dollar display. She was close to all the Mockbell crowd, and especially close to some of them. Police surveillance spotted Gobbo taking delivery of a red briefcase from one of the men, and it is thought that investigators suspected she might be committing crimes. Another time, she met an associate late in the evening outside the supper club in the city for the exchange of what was described in a later court case as a small item. By early 2006, Gobbo was trying again, telling police about drug deals worth millions. Shortly after, her intimate proximities gave her hallowed status and unfettered access when Melbourne's underworld was invited to a birthday party for one of the Chemical Brothers. The celebration was a leave pass, an excuse to forget. The past few months had been rough for the birthday boy. He was in poor health, in another Walter White touch, and wondered how long he had to live. Life was tough for the other Chemical Brothers too. Some were about to enter rehab and were regularly visiting psychiatrists for personality disorders. Some faced decades in jail for earlier offences. They had bought 21st birthday presents for their primary school-aged kids, knowing that they would not be there. The party loomed as a kind of last supper for the most unchristian of characters. Even the media were tipped off about it. Milad Mokbel was among the 150 or so people who gathered at Upmarket Wheat, usually a venue for lawyers. That night it was overrun by hard nuts and head kickers. Drug importer Rob Karam was there too, taking time out from fighting massive drug charges. He chatted with Fidel Fred the Bear D'Amico. The pair hadn't fallen out, yet. A nightclub owner with Valentino stylings, D'Amico would survive two murder plots, including one that Karam would be questioned about. D'Amico would be a preliminary suspect in what later became the biggest ecstasy haul ever, but he would not be charged. Tony Mokbel himself was a no-show, perhaps preoccupied with his own fate. In 9 days' time, for reasons that will be revealed in a later chapter, he would dematerialise and trigger Australia's most unusual manhunt. Expense was not an issue in organising the party, but the birthday boy didn't pay for his party up front. He always seemed to be short. Instead, the $17,000 cafe bill was put on Gobbo's Visa card. Nor did the birthday boy accept the RSVPs. Gobbo looked after those too. He had wanted topless waitresses at his party, but she had told him no. Gobbo was a natural-born hostess. She won the dance competition and gave a speech. In a photo taken on the night, a Mokbel associate can be seen cupping her breasts, off his head on gear, as Gobbo later described him. In taking on the role of chief organiser, Gobbo wasn't just being helpful. She had arranged the RSVPs so she could pass on the names of the attendees to her handlers. Police surveillance noted each arrival and departure. Gobbo was their spy on the inside. She borrowed a police camera to photograph the baddies under the pretense of taking happy snaps. Gobbo was thriving in these early days of her 3838 subterfuge. Weeks before the party, she had rung her handlers from a restaurant bathroom after she ate with two drug-running associates, presumably unable to wait to pass on intelligence. She had also suggested that an undercover agent could play her boyfriend for the birthday party, so that he too could get intimate with Melbourne's baddest. Police had at first embraced her idea of a covert agent as the DJ, but ultimately decided against it. The different parts of Gobbo's life had no cohesion by this point. As a conventional lawyer, she'd been invited to the 60th birthday of Robert Richter QC the previous month. As a rogue lawyer, she met Tony Mokbel in Parks. Police couldn't listen in Parks. She dined with crime lords who compared the selling points of their prostitutes. They preened and plotted, the next deal the subject of every exchange. Sometimes their wives and mistresses came along. Gobbo strained for snippets of their chatter too. One of Gobbo's handlers later called her the octopus. Her tentacles reached to the most unlikely of places. Gobbo was told in confidence about a $4 million crook involving two mockbells and another group headed by Mario Condello, a solicitor who had chosen a life of crime. The Carlton Cruise money man, who was a loan shark and into art scams, Condello was shot dead outside his Brighton East home in an unsolved crime in February 2006. She was also told about a lab in Preston, around the corner from Regent Street. Her growing list of tips was guiding investigators towards an impending sting. At the same time, the Chemical Brothers' paranoia was swelling. One of the associates was alternating between three cars, including a Mercedes with a secret compartment for storing guns. He confronted the driver of a Mitsubishi Magna that followed him to a service station. Mr. Average turned up to Gobbo's office, shaken, a few weeks after the birthday party. "We're fucking burnt," he told her. Mr. Average had spotted police surveillance cars near Milad Mockbell's home. He and the apprentice drove into car parks and laneways and around the block to shake their tails. He compiled a list, identifying three police cars from the Piranha Task Force. Gobbo sought to quell his panic. If detectives were following him, she argued, it meant they didn't know where the drugs were. Yet she inwardly seethed. She was exasperated by police incompetence, she told her handlers. She couldn't believe the Piranha detectives had been so obvious. The timing of the planned sting was shifting from day to day, hour to hour. Her handlers tasked her to gain as much intelligence as she could to provide updates on the associates' whereabouts. When she furnished them with specific details of a drug lab, they tracked a car used by one of Mockbell's men from a strip club to an address near a primary school not far from the park where Jason Moran was killed less than 3 years earlier. The selection of a lab site so close to a school would divide the Chemical Brothers. Gobbo was told that the Chemical Brothers might be pissing blood because of their heavy workload with dangerous chemicals. But the cooks were delayed so that the crew could spend Easter with their families. They couldn't know that they were enjoying their last days of freedom. A subtext runs through the police information reports at this time. Gobbo was juggling guilt and excitement. She told her handlers that she was informing to ease her conscience for having helped criminals in the past, but when they raised conflict issues about her desire to represent the same criminals after their arrest, she replied, "What conflict?" Police had conducted a review of their star recruit soon after Gobbo began informing in 2005. Her informer registration reactivation application was updated in April 2006, not long before the Mockbell crew members were arrested. There were no other written reviews of Gobbo's work as informer 3838, apart from so-called SWOT analyses, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, from time to time on specific issues. The review concluded that many police officers knew of Gobbo's secret role. Unidentified close work associates of those police officers might also know, as well as members of the Australian Federal Police. Within months, dozens of detectives were folded into the Gobbo subterfuge, and eventually 100 or more police officers would know about her unethical assistance. The risk of exposure, officialese for murder, through casual conversation or otherwise, was considered high. Gobbo's intimate relationships with police officers and her enjoyment of the company of male police officers posed a high risk too. Of significant risk was Gobbo's reaction when police did not act on her intelligence. A feeling of frustration may cause the source to take unknown radical action in order to rid herself of contact with these people. The overall risk of her use was considered high, yet the review found that 3838 was both strategically and tactically viable. The conclusion sounds absurd now, as it was then. The more intelligence Gobbo provided, the bigger the chance she would end up in a body bag. Police raided the drug lab in April as the lone bugler warmed up for his annual solo performance at Melbourne's Shrine of Remembrance Dawn Service. Two chemical brothers were the first to be arrested, and both would be represented by Gobbo. A version of the raid story has been well told over the years, a tale seemingly steeped in good fortune. Yet the police account omitted the fact that luck played almost no part. The story goes like this. A Piranha detective was walking with his daughter. She heard a faint drilling sound, which turned out to be coming from the meth lab. The fluke find sounds highly unlikely in the absence of a starting point, which we now know to be Gobbo's tip-off. Gobbo was both elated and saddened when she heard about the arrests. The right thing also felt like the wrong thing. Here was a job done, and hello to a new set of dangers. She thrilled at the gravity of the situation. She asked her handler before meeting her clients in need, "Who's next?" One of the chemical brothers offered a no-comment interview to investigators, who asked 29 questions in the space of 5 minutes. But the detectives didn't need him to cooperate in this first interview. They had a backup plan. She was hovering in the courtyard of the nearby Emerald Hotel, awaiting her cue. Gobbo and her handlers had spoken beforehand about her client's inevitable desire to speak to her after his arrest. She argued that she had to turn up for him because her absence would trigger his suspicions. Self-preservation meant more to her than ethics. Gobbo was told to ignore her handlers when she arrived at the police station. She had incriminated the chemical brothers. Now, in phase two, she would convince one of them to roll on his mates and set off a chain reaction. Much planning preceded the event. Gobbo and police had discussed the profile she'd compiled over the past 7 months, even the type of cigarettes that should be offered. "Winnie Blues?" her handlers inquired. Gobbo said it didn't matter, just not menthol. Gobbo got the call late in the afternoon. She met with her client for about an hour. They sat at a basic table with two chairs. Client and lawyer held hands as she cried over his arrest. The condemned was comforting his executioner. He worried that she would be criminally implicated in his crimes. The irony was that he wanted to protect the woman who had orchestrated his arrest. Many years later, the duped client described the scene. "She looked so distressed. She was shaking her head from side to side saying, 'No, I can't fix this.' I told her not to worry. She said, 'They know everything.' Of course they did, because she had told them everything." The man would say Gobbo advised him he would do 30 years jail. She was very convincing. The best result he could hope for, she said, would be 23 years. He owed the Mockbells nothing. His family would lose everything. He had to roll for himself and for them. "I couldn't fathom the idea," he would say later. Gobbo, the actress, thrived in the role of sympathetic friend. "She told me I needed to make a deal. Let me go speak with them and sort something out." Gobbo walked out of the room and repeated the conversation she'd had with her client to her handler in what was a gross legal breach. She left the police station, but the arrested man asked for her to return soon afterwards. He and Gobbo later walked into the midst of a pizza party, as she would call it, in the boardroom of Piranha headquarters on the 14th floor of the St Kilda Road police complex. She and her handler, Peter Smith, pretended not to know each other. Detective Sergeant Dale Flynn spoke privately with the client and Gobbo in another room for 2 hours. It was called The Pitch, and Flynn said it was simple. The client was shown photos of his family and asked if he cared to see them in the next few decades. Flynn took no notes, an odd choice since police routinely notate everything from trivial phone calls to pivotal moments. By the meeting's end, the client had changed his mind. Offered an out, he accepted. All he had to do was risk his life and roll on the mockbells. Flynn would tell the Royal Commission in 2019 that it was Gobbo who persuaded the chemical brother to roll on the mockbells during this discussion. The client himself would say that he would never have rolled if Gobbo had not returned to the station and encouraged him to do so. She wouldn't dispute the claim. The doomed man then sat down with Flynn and Detective Senior Constable Paul Rowe, who had helped recruit Gobbo as an informer 7 months earlier. It was 9:08 p.m. Breaks for coffees and non-menthol cigarettes slowed the process, so that it was 11:27 p.m. before the interview ended. Police asked the client a total of 456 questions. He told them he worked his arse off for very little and that the mockbells owed him a lot of money. Yes, he would help sting his associates. He would plead guilty and swap sides. Gobbo slept poorly that night. She thought she was going to be killed once the mockbells found out about the arrests. As their fixer lawyer, she was supposed to warn them whenever a henchman was arrested by police. Her satisfaction over the arrest was also dimmed by guilt. "We have been victims of the same disease," one of the chemical brothers had once told her, referring to the mockbells. "The general ethics of all this is fucked," she told her handlers prior to the arrest. Yet her empathy was limited. One of the arrested men told her that the police had overlooked hidden guns in their raid that day. She alerted them to their oversight. They retrieved the guns and laid firearms charges. This isolated detail stands as one of the most clear-cut breaches of legal professional privilege in Gobbo's years of informing. International legal precedents are uniform in this regard. If police act on legally privileged information, prosecutions should always fall over. By the next night, Gobbo sought praise from her handlers. She wanted thanks for her key role in dismantling a drug empire. She had located the drug lab for police, then persuaded one of those arrested at the lab to give up his bosses. The morning after her client's arrest, Gobbo's biggest sting was already in motion. Her client was sent to work in his new role of criminal informer. He checked in with the apprentice to maintain a pretense of normality. Their chat would directly lead to that man going to jail. The snitch then met Milad Mockbell at the Grove Cafe in Melbourne's Inner North to discuss prospective fictional meth deals. He wore a wire to record the conversation. The day after, he met Mr. Beautiful at an Avondale Heights car wash in northwest Melbourne, probably the one that Gobbo co-owned. She had bought into it in recent months, and her investment had delivered wads of cash that would be spotted in both her car and her home. Car washes are good places for criminals to talk. The roar of the car wash water drowns out bugs, and therefore they are bad places for lawyers to be seen to invest their money. That day, however, the snitch again wore a wire, which picked up his discussion with his drug colleague about a pill press and ecstasy manufacturer. His work was not yet done. Next, he arranged to meet Milad Mockbell again. He was the bigger prize. On Anzac Day 2006, the snitch turned up at Milad's home with fake drugs wrapped up as a present, in typical Mockbell style. Both men were arrested as they left the house, the snitch as show. The snitching associate had chosen his path. After doing the police's bidding and nailing his criminal mates, he was remanded. His reward would be a remarkably short sentence. But he didn't feel lucky. He would spend many hours drafting statements against his former mates and appearing in courtrooms where his character and reliability were trashed. In jail, the man had no friends or money. On the outside, the families of the chemical brothers squabbled over the snitch. He was labelled a dog. Gobbo began funding him in prison with about $190 a month. She wanted him to have a doona and pillow. The expenses would eventually reach $20,000, much of it paid by Victoria Police when Gobbo asked them to take over the payments. It wasn't much if you accept the Associate's sensational claim that he gave Gobbo $250,000 or more for safekeeping prior to his arrest, which she vehemently denied. If he was going mad, so was Gobbo. For 6 months she had conspired with police to arrest and charge the Mockbell crew members. She'd listened to her clients' fears, absorbed their threats, and accepted their legal fees. She was sad about her dwindling income. She had helped imprison some of her best clients, who weren't the most prompt of payers even in good times. But now that they were locked up and awaiting trial, the risks to Gobbo only compounded. The Office of Police Integrity, OPI, wanted to speak to her in early 2006. OPI Assistant Director Graham Ashton believed Gobbo's evidence would be important to a new probe about the leaking of Terry Hodson's informer history. She was to be the main event, alongside Chief Hodson murder suspect Paul Dale and their mutual friend, Detective Tim Argyll, at a July hearing to be chaired by Tony Fitzgerald, QC. Gobbo was rocked by the prospect, as were her police handlers. Legal examination by the OPI could expose her secret informing. She would face the same risks again and again in all judicial forums in which she was called to give evidence. Internal police discussions focused on shielding Gobbo from the witness box. As her controller Sandy White understood it, Overland was to speak to Ashton about having Gobbo excused. Superintendent Tony Biggin wrote in his police diary at the time that Overland did not think it was in the public interest for Gobbo to participate in a hearing. Ashton would recall these events differently in 2019, although his recollections were hazy. He couldn't explain why the OPI investigation was aborted in 2006. He maintained that he did not know that Gobbo was a police informer until the following year, when Gobbo was compelled to appear at an OPI hearing about the Hodson murders and was accused of lying in the witness box. Ashton rejected any implication that Overland had convinced him to drop the 2006 OPI hearing. In the week after the Mockbell-related arrests, an incensed, haughty Mockbell told Gobbo that the betrayer is a dog and soon to be a dead man. Haughty hoped that Gobbo had not fucked this man. He had no information, just suspicions, and Gobbo maintained a calm front. A week later, according to a police information report tendered in court, she said that Haughty materialized in her office and grabbed her by the throat. He openly accused her of informing. Gobbo had a watertight cover. She had been criminally suspected by police for her past enabling of the Mockbells. She was on the Mockbells' side. It was a deft answer under pressure, and Haughty removed his hand. He was testing her, caveman style. But he wasn't totally convinced. In leaving, he said he would not speak to Gobbo again unless she was naked. He wanted to be certain she was not wearing a wire. 10 days later, she advised the snitch on how to make him bulletproof under cross-examination. 3838 to check the associate's statements and still wants to negotiate the best position for him as a client, regardless of how he got into that position. An information report read. Her home doorbell rang for the first time in 12 months. She wasn't home very often, usually only to catch a few hours of sleep. No one was at the door when she looked. 5 days later, the tyres on her BMW were flat. Haughty Mockbell asked if her apartment was for sale, which she took as a coded warning that he knew where she lived. In a police information report, it was noted that Piranha Police had got word that one of Carl Williams's mates was mouthing off in prison about her. According to police information reports tendered in court, Roberta Williams was saying Gobbo could be knocked. She rang to tell Gobbo to keep fucking the snitch. Gobbo receded into despair. Stress gushed from a myriad of sources. She feared her informer's secret was already becoming common knowledge. Upset is not the word, she told a handler, who wrote, 3838 believes is in worse position because of trying to do the right thing. 3838 obviously very upset and crying uncontrollably. She spoke to her handlers about ending the information flow. She was feeling the burden of these people. 3838 thinks only way to stop is gradually. As people get arrested, they will drop off. But 3838 whinging about how much time things take. 3838 advised to get more sleep. Her handlers had suggested she slow her informing at various times in these opening months. But they'd never actually stopped her. Deluged with almost as many demands as pieces of information, they had become more than conduits. They were concerned for their secret weapon. It seems stress was bringing on drastic health changes. Gobbo had always blamed stress for her stroke in 2004. Now, a doctor had found a small lump in her breast, though he believed it could be treated with antibiotics. She had checked in with her heart surgeon. She was losing weight, fast, and not because she subscribed to the first two of the three C's of weight loss, coffee, cigarettes and cocaine. She shed more than 40 kilograms rapidly, and she visited a succession of doctors about cancer fears. There were her emotional concerns too. She turned down a police offer of a psychiatrist, stating that talking to handlers helped. She was adamant that her informing was stress relief rather than stressful. Another report from as far back as February 2006 indicated that Gobbo was worried her controller Sandy White was not impressed by her. Here were the beginnings of an unhealthy symbiosis. She needed to be validated by White, her father figure. An information report from August 2006 reads, "Source wants to know if any other person has helped as much as she has, and if anyone comes close, she needs to be told so she can try harder." Gobbo was told of her comfortable lead. When White chatted with Gobbo in a recorded conversation in mid-2006, her nasal tone flared with feeling. She sounded weary, older than her 33 years, more Kalgoorlie than Q, like a no-nonsense country girl after a long day drenching sheep. What Gobbo said scuttles any claim that both she and Victoria Police were oblivious to the legalities of her informing. Gobbo knew what she was doing. "I've chucked ethics out the window," she said. "I've chucked legal professional privilege out the window. I've chucked my career out the window. If any of this ever came out, I would be so fucked it's not funny." There was one bright spot ahead. A big date was coming up, the 16th of September. It would be her 12-month anniversary as an informer. In that time, she had produced more than 1,250 information reports, at an average of almost 3.5 a day, including Christmas Day. Her productiveness as an informer was rising as the months wore on. Gobbo wanted her handlers to make good on their promise. She wanted a celebratory lunch. It's unclear if it actually took place, but it's fair to assume that her handlers flinched at her insistence on being appreciated. Two handlers and Gobbo did meet in the Mercure Hotel in Swanston Street at the end of October 2006. The get-together lasted more than 4 hours. Gobbo ordered a large, strong, skinny latte and later some white wine. The easy rapport between the informer and her keepers jumps out of the transcript. At one point, a handler mentions that Gobbo seems happy. "What's going on?" "Had a bit of bang, bang, bang." The attendees knew the meeting was recorded, but must have assumed the recording would never be aired. Milad Mokbel was an idiot. He owed many people money, including $30,000 to Gobbo. The Mokbels had suffered for their arrogance. They'd assumed their might would eliminate threats from within. Greed and hubris had brought them down. Gobbo felt old-fashioned Catholic guilt for having once helped such bastards with their legal concerns, and affection for one of the chemical brothers who would give you the last 20 cents in his pocket. At a certain point in the transcript, one of the dirty secrets of the Gobbo conspiracy is revealed in all its devilishness. Gobbo dons her glasses to peruse the Piranha briefs of evidence against the arrested Mokbel crew members. Here was the beginning of a pattern that would continue throughout her years as informer 3838. She acted as a one-stop shop. She helped apprehend the crooks, then assess the evidence against them for weaknesses. Her instinct for self-preservation drove these improper exercises. Gobbo was ensuring that the evidence did not identify her as having betrayed her clients. She met repeatedly with investigators to assess associates' draft statements, which she concluded were thorough. She helped one of them with 40 statements that would help convict up to 10 others. His statements conflicted with one another. He lied to exclude Gobbo from statements and hide her involvement from the Mokbels. Statements, mind you, that Gobbo helped prepare. A sense of omnipotence oozes from the police information reports on this topic. The crims were pawns to be manipulated. The courts would be told only what Gobbo and the police wanted them to hear. She and her handlers tweaked the official narrative to suit their needs. They breached legal professional privilege and they stacked the deck against fairness and transparency. They thought it was okay, so long as no one found out. As soon as they were arrested, all of the chemical brothers, charged as a direct result of Gobbo's information, bar Horty Mokbel, rang her for legal advice. Milad Mokbel was sentenced to 8 years in prison for trafficking amphetamines. Brother Horty was not charged until April 2007. Represented by Levi Diamond, he was accused of trafficking methamphetamine and precursor chemicals. His case was suppressed from public view, but he was cleared of the charges despite a snitching associate's evidence against him. Mr. Beautiful was charged in June 2006 and agreed to give evidence against Tony Mokbel and others. He received a suspended 3-year sentence for trafficking MDMA. Gobbo was desperate that Mr. Beautiful was spared jail time. She was infatuated with him and confided to a legal colleague that she wanted to marry him. When he was picked up by Detective Senior Constable Paul Rowe in June 2006, he asked to speak to Gobbo on the phone. "Do you want me to come down there?" she asked Mr. Beautiful. "Yeah, absolutely," he replied. Gobbo then asked him to put Rowe back on the phone. "He wants me to come down there," she told Rowe. "Do you want to ring me back when you get back there and I'll see if I can avoid coming there?" So much for unfettered legal advice. The apprentice was charged with one count of drug trafficking. One of his former mates was the star witness against him, in a trial featuring allegations against Gobbo. In 2015, the apprentice would write a letter to Justice Murray Kellam, who was inquiring into Gobbo's behaviour for the Independent Broad-Based Anti-Corruption Commission, IBAC. "I'm adamant Victoria Police acted improperly in their dealing with an associate and others," he wrote. "The lengths police went to orchestrate convictions and ensure my demise in what can only be described as shady, dishonest and corrupt undertakings are mind-blowing." 5 years later, the man still seethed in jail. 6 years later, he was freed on bail over concerns that Gobbo's conduct had tainted his conviction. He knew the truth on his release. Gobbo had betrayed them. Mr. Average, on the other hand, had no idea. He was very close to Gobbo, his best friend, through the years before and after his incarceration, and he applied to the parole board to live with her on his release. The application was unsuccessful. The pair exchanged 40,000 text messages. After his release, he and Gobbo would call one another precious in some of these messages. She told him about a party dress she planned to wear without underwear. "Let me thank you so much for a lovely dinner, Nick, and great company," he wrote in one message. "Despite all of your ailments, you look incredibly beautiful. And to be totally honest, I was a little lost for words and didn't say half the things I intended to say." Earlier, Gobbo had written to him, "I'm home tucked under a blanket on my couch, reading, and just thinking how nice it was to see you and have a laugh. You haven't aged at all, and still have an incredible knack for telling stories in a very funny way. Years may have passed, but it doesn't feel like it in lots of ways. We'll be in touch. Drive safely, hun, and don't let anything overwhelm you, because you are one in a million. Kiss, kiss, kiss." The Hodsons were a first stumble on Gobbo's journey, and the Mockbell operations the next. Another instalment of Gobbo's crazy adventure was her involvement with Shifty, a hitman who became the first supergrass of modern gangland. He and Gobbo set out to destroy the upstart responsible for starting the gangland war, Carl Williams.